Welcome to Mission Business, a podcast about good business for those in the business of good, presented by your part-time controller, LLC, also known as YPTC. My name is Jennifer Oliva, the host of Mission Business and YPTC CEO. In this episode, I speak with Lauren Cristella, President and CEO of Committee of 70. Lauren is the first woman to hold this position in the nearly 120-year history of this nonprofit and nonpartisan organization. Committee of 70 combats corruption and promotes political civic engagement. And now, my conversation with my friend, Lauren Cristella. Live from Philadelphia, face-to-face with Lauren Cristella. How you doing?
Thanks so much for having me. I'm doing really well.
You and I go way back. We were at Fells together when I taught at the Fells Institute of Government at the University of Pennsylvania. You worked there. We put together the Women in Nonprofit Leadership Conference in Philadelphia for 3 years. We were partners in crime with that. It was great times.
Before times, before COVID.
Before COVID, that's right. That's right. And now you're a client of ours at the Committee of 70, client of your part-time controller. So this is such a great, long-lasting relationship. I'm so excited to interview you today.
Thanks so much. I'm thrilled to be here and excited to share all the good stuff happening at 70.
And first of all, congratulations on becoming the CEO of Committee of 70. How long has it been?
I got the promotion back in June, so we're going 6 or 7 months.
Okay. I can't wait to pick your brain because, as you may know, I'm taking the role of CEO at YPTC.
Yes, congratulations.
Thank you. March 1st. Today is February 19th that we are taping, but March, just a few weeks. So we'll have to compare notes, and I'm looking forward to networking with you, us fellow female CEOs.
I think it's a little easier ascending internally than coming in from the outside. I guess there's pros and cons for both.
But, yes. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a similar path. We both are succeeding men long time in the position. So it's a similar trajectory. So it's, we'll have a lot of things in common to talk about. So let's talk about the Committee of 70. Tell me what the Committee of 70 is all about.
Sure. The Committee of 70 is a 120-year-old nonpartisan nonprofit with bipartisan support dedicated to helping voters vote and then also advocating for reforms that make our government more efficient, effective, and accountable to the public.
Great mission. I mean, you've been really on the forefront of voter registration and also drawing the lines for voter boundaries, I guess. I know I'm using the wrong terminology, but you can let me know. So tell me about the specific programs that you have at Committee of 70.
Yes, you're thinking of our statewide redistricting program,
Draw
the Lines. Mm-hmm. Yep. And that was really successful going back from maybe 2017, 2018 through the new maps. And we're actually starting that work again, preparing for the next round of maps that we'll have in 2030. Basically, the Committee of 70 focuses on a few different major initiatives. One is our youth civic education programming. That's our investment in the future of democracy, right? Civic education has basically not been a priority for at least 30 years in the United States. And we really are seeing the consequences of that, right? So we knew, especially after the good work that we did in Draw the Line statewide, working with teachers in high schools and middle schools and colleges across the Commonwealth, that we had a great base to launch this civic education programming. So we have election curriculum for high school students and middle school students. We start with kindergartners as early as five-year-olds, really teaching them about what it means to be a member of a community, right? What's your first community, your family, and then it goes to your classroom and you build out until you're a citizen of your nation. And those skills of citizenship are so important to start early. So we've got a fantastic curriculum that does that. We have a mock election program. We engage 17-year-olds around serving as poll workers. In Pennsylvania, you can be 17 and serve as a poll worker. And in a lot of places, we've done some advocacy work to make sure that schools are counting those hours served towards the service hours a lot of schools need for graduation or require. So that's our youth civic education programming. We also work with business leaders and nonprofits to promote a culture of voting within their organization. There's a ton of research that shows that employers are still trusted messengers at a time when there's a lot of misinformation and disinformation. Asking people who they trust, their employers often end up high on that list. So recognizing that, and Committee of 70 has long had terrific relationships with the business community in the greater Philadelphia area, we want to use that network to share our nonpartisan resources so that every voter can be informed when they vote, vote with confidence, and just have what they need, right, to make sure that they can successfully cast their ballot. So working with all of these other, we're up to 165 partners across the state.
Wow.
And it's been just a terrific program and way to meet the needs of those communities, because employers say, great, this is something we want to do. We want to promote active citizenship or people voting within our organization. We're not telling them who to vote for. But other than that, we don't know what we're doing, right? Mm-hmm. So we come in with a full program that makes it very easy for them to share this information and promote that culture of voting in their organization.
Oh, wow. How do businesses and nonprofits get involved, become a partner with Committee of 70?
Yep. They email the Committee of 70 at ourbettergov@70.org. Tanisha Beju is our new program director. Uh-huh. She spent 13 years in the classroom and is just a remarkable educator. And now she's working with the public, right? So partnering with all of these organizations to give them exactly what they need. We can tailor those resources to meet each organization where they are on that ladder of civic engagement. So it starts with just a commitment to share, hey, an election's coming up. Check your voter registration. Here's the deadline. Here's 70's nonpartisan voter guide. So you can learn about all the candidates on the ballot and the offices and what they do. That's the bare minimum commitment. Uh-huh. We create sample communications, all kinds of things that make that very easy. And then we go all the way up to organizations who give the day off to employees. Wow. So that they can serve as poll workers or poll watchers. Mm-hmm. Some organizations bring us in to do trainings. So we'll do information sessions about how to vote by mail or how to successfully cast their ballot in person. We'll do sessions for what does it mean to be a poll worker or poll watcher, supplementing those trainings and things that are offered by each county. So it really depends on the level of engagement or interest that the company has. And often we'll see people come in at that bare minimum kind of level of committing to share our information. And then after a year or two, a few cycles, they have employees, 50 employees are taking the day off to serve as poll workers. It's pretty terrific to see.
That's great. And is that PA-centric or is that across the country?
Our platinum resources are certainly for Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. but we acknowledge that obviously a lot of these companies pull employees from the region and some are national, right? So we make sure we provide good information on how to cast your ballot, what the deadlines are for any state in the nation. This program's called We Vote. So in this organization, We Vote. It's kind of a statement of values.
That's awesome. Switching gears a little bit, I want to go back to the conversation about leadership and being the leader of a nonprofit organization and being the first woman leader at the Committee of 70 in its entire history, 120 years.
Yes.
What's that like?
Sometimes it's a little embarrassing because it took us that long to get there. But no, it's an honor to be in that position. And especially at a time when women leadership is on the rise, right? We have women, the first woman mayor in the history of Philadelphia, Sherelle Parker.
Yeah.
Shelley Cameron is the head of the Philadelphia Chamber of Commerce. She's the first woman in, I think it's close to 300 years, something crazy, however long the chamber's been in existence. Our first, speaker of the House in Joanna McClinton. Mm-hmm. And it's just an incredible time for female leadership. And I'm kind of humbled to be mentioned in the same breath as a lot of those women.
I'd love to hear about some of the women that were important in your career, somebody that helped you become the leader that you are.
I have been so fortunate to have phenomenal mentors, both women and men alike. Mm-hmm. I think obviously women who are carrying as they climb is so important, and I try to do that myself, and especially with all those women at Fells and other people I was lucky to serve as a mentor to. But it's also important for men to see that as their responsibility too, to chart those paths for women as well. But certainly mine starts with my mother. I mean, just such a terrific example of what strong, compassionate leadership looks like. She did that in her professional life, working in a doctor's office, but then certainly at our home too. And just an incredible work ethic. And then I was so lucky. My first job out of graduate school was at the National Constitution Center here in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And the cohort of women leaders in that organization are among my closest friends. If you see, Curry Sautner is the new CEO of Eastern State Penitentiary. Yes. I was so fortunate to work under her in my first role there. Stephanie Ryer is a leader at the University of the Arts right now. Yeah. Just incredible leaders to learn from and to really show me the ropes and encourage me to take big steps.
And at Fells, at the Fells Institute of Government, you worked with David Thornburg as your leader there and then followed him, I guess, over to the Committee of 70. Tell me a little bit about that relationship. I mean, I do think it's, like you said, men and women, mentors. And I can see that David was a big influence in your career as well.
Absolutely. David is such a remarkable civic leader. And I think kind of a civic entrepreneur, right? Mm-hmm. He came up with new ideas and programs. And it was such a fantastic opportunity to work closely with him and to learn from him. And to think big. I mean, I think that's one of the biggest lessons. But then he also did create those paths, right? I stayed at Fells a few years after he joined the Committee of 70. And then he called me to get the band back together and basically created a new role for me. I didn't want to just do fundraising and development work. And so he just made it happen, right? Made a position that was really exciting to me and included such a diversity of opportunity and then really got a chance to grow into that and kept expanding my portfolio until it made sense to take that big jump to CEO.
Speaking of Fells, what is your feeling about students going into a master's in public administration program to prepare themselves for a career in public life or for a nonprofit?
This is one of my soapbox issues.
Oh, love it.
So for anyone who's thinking about law school but doesn't want to be a lawyer, consider an MPA or an MPP instead, please. No, I think it is so important. And I think public service has such a bad rap sometimes. We, you know, think about politicians and say that with such a negative connotation. But truly, the people who go to programs like Fells and that MPA program get fast-tracked. I thought my master's degree in ethics, politics, and public policy was very practical until I started working at Fells. And I was like, oh no, they're teaching you how to budget and they're teaching you fundraising and all these other things. And it was like, oh, I had to learn all of this on the job and ask 5,000 questions. And if I had just had the opportunity to study that in a classroom with, you know, fantastically committed peers and educators, it's just such a huge value and it supercharges, I think, people's career and their ability to have an impact even faster.
I couldn't agree with you more. And the students at Fells are, I felt very prepared for public service in working for a nonprofit. And I knew they knew budgeting because I taught them that. Talk a little bit more about Committee of 70 and the advocacy for voter access and rights.
Yes.
Big topic.
So we've kept David Thornburg. He's no longer the CEO, but he's now running our major advocacy initiative around open primaries. Pennsylvania is one of just a few states that is totally closed. We do not have open primaries here. So you have to pick one of the two major parties to be able to vote in a primary, or you can't vote at all. You can only vote on ballot questions, right? No candidates. And in places like Philadelphia, where the voter registration is 7 or 8 to 1 Democrats to Republican, the primary is basically the election, right? After this last primary, we knew it was very likely that Sherelle Parker was going to be our mayor. So if you're an independent, you have to remember 15 days before the election to switch your party or to declare a party so that you can vote in that election or you're shut out. And I can't tell you how many smart, active, engaged people forget to do that, right? Yeah. They are an independent voter as a statement of values, which is their choice. And then that deadline comes and they miss it.
And they're shut out.
And they're shut out of the election. So there's over 1 million registered independents or third party voters in Pennsylvania. And to think, I mean, Philadelphia is not the only place with lopsided registration, right? There's red parts of the state as well. And these voters just don't get a say often in their elections. So we want to change that. Basically, with open primaries, the version that we're advocating for, you would be able to declare your party on the day of the election and get handed that ballot, right? So you don't actually have to switch your party. You say, give me a Republican ballot or a Democratic ballot. and then you vote.
That makes a ton of sense.
We think so. A lot of other places do it this way. This is not anything terribly new or uncommon. And it's really important. It would also go a very long way in moderating the politics that we're seeing. If you think about what it takes, certainly in some of these state level races, like the last governor's race, these Senate races, the candidates have to run to the extremes of their own party, right, to rally their base to come out. Because they're the most reliable voters in any given primary. If they could appeal to independent voters, you would see much more moderate messaging. They would really focus on issues much more likely, right? That would appeal to the widest variety of Pennsylvanians of voters. So it's really something that we think is good for democracy, not just in terms of, you know, taxation without representation, right? All of these people are paying for these elections, these primaries to happen with their tax dollars, and they're shut out. But also because it would be a moderating force in our politics.
That's very educational. How much is that an issue in the whole country?
So a lot of places already have open primaries,
right?
Or they have same day voter registration, which is the same, right? You can switch your registration the day of the election. So we're really just one of a handful of states right now that has this totally closed system.
Do you think it's going to turn around?
We're trying very, very hard. I think it's hard to say in an election year like this one, where Pennsylvania is kind of in the eye of the storm with a national election. I think legislators might be very hesitant to touch anything in the election code, even some desperately needed things like pre-canvassing and risk-limiting audits, things that would be no-brainers in any other year. As with so many things at the Committee of 70, the fights that we're fighting are the work of years. None of this happens overnight or within, you know, 6 months, you know, in a single legislative session. It's really the coalition building, the advocacy, the public engagement that takes years.
So we are in an election year. This is a big, big year for Committee of 70. What are your goals for this year? What do you think is going to happen?
Our goal is every eligible voter voting, being informed when they vote, and voting with confidence. That is my goal. So we're working in parts of the city that have 8% turnout, right? I want to get that number up, because if you don't make your voice heard, you're not speaking for your community, it's much easier to ignore you when those people inevitably get elected with or without you, right? So we are really working hard to reach communities that we haven't historically been active in, and finding the trusted messengers in those communities, hearing what they need, what would resonate. They know their community best. And we're very fortunate to have the capacity to create those resources and meet people where they are. So that's the work that's happening right now. We certainly are on the poll worker recruitment and training. Same with poll watchers. And so that people can understand the difference between a poll worker and a poll watcher, and who exactly can do what in a polling place or when they're watching the count, right? We think that when people are informed and they know what those jobs are, even if they have questions about the integrity of our system, we're calling them in. Come in. You have questions. You're not sure. You think there might be fraud. Serve as a poll worker for 13 hours and see everything that goes into what it takes to pull off an election, how many people have a role to play, all the different checks and balances. It will allay a lot of fears, I think.
Speaking of fears, how do you commit to proper information out about the fairness of the elections?
We are a trust but verify. I'm never going to tell people to just blindly trust a system or their government, right? But we work so closely with our government officials. We're watching the process, you know, 365 days a year, not just twice a year when the big elections are happening, or in even number of years, right? I'd like to think that because of the role we play and how active we are in our watchdog role, that people can trust us when we say, you can trust this process, right? Or here's where to look. Here's the questions to ask. These are your elected officials. They're not some big, scary, anonymous, you know, man behind the curtain. It's your neighbors, right? Your election officials are in your community. The people serving as poll workers can only be registered voters in the county where they're serving. These are your neighbors. They're not coming from far away to steal the election or to cause interference, right? And then the same, we're creating videos that show every part of that mail-in ballot process. So if you fill it out and you drop it in a Dropbox, what happens? We're going to trace that and show with our good friends at Primitive World Productions producing that video again this year as they did in 2020. Some of this fear and anxiety comes from not knowing, right? Yeah. They don't have the information. They haven't seen it for themselves. So let's shine a big bright light on the whole process. There's nothing to hide. And I think election officials would say the same. So we're trying to illuminate that process as much as possible.
One of the strategies that Community 70 has to get voters out to the polls is to support civic time off. Tell me a little bit about that program and how you support that.
Absolutely. So we've all heard of PTO. Mm-hmm. This is CTO. We are encouraging, and that's definitely through that We Vote program. This is one of the higher rungs on the civic engagement ladder.
Got it.
Encouraging employees, giving them CTO, civic time off. So that's whether it's celebrating voter registration day and having some parties and reminding everyone to update or check their voter registration, all the way to giving time off to vote, flexible time, the morning off, or the whole day off to serve as a poll worker, to serve as a poll watcher. These are really important roles. The need is there in every community across Pennsylvania. We need 40,000 poll workers here to step up twice a year, every year. And basically about half come back every year. So even recruiting 20,000 people, it's a lot to fill those roles. We want to make sure people are informed and engaged and that they feel comfortable giving the amount of time it needs, right? A lot of places don't offer shift work. So you have to commit, you know, to basically being there at 6 o'clock, 6:30 in the morning and staying until that last person in line at 8 o'clock casts their ballot and then you close down the polls. So you're looking at like 9:30 in a lot of places. It's a long day.
So there must be some connection between the We Vote program and businesses and nonprofits supporting civic responsibility and retention of employees, or at least maybe that's one of the points of a value proposition for an organization.
Absolutely. Well, I think businesses are seeing that, you know, millennials, Gen Z, they expect this from their employer. They expect good corporate citizenship. And what we found in our research is that employers that offer these programs or make this time experience higher employee retention, better morale. There's a business case to be made for why this is good for your bottom line, let alone for organizations that depend on certain political outcomes. They might not be promoting a specific candidate, but you know, public health organizations have a stake in this, arts organizations, right? Different funding. So we're finding that we don't have to twist any arms to get a lot of employers to see the value in a program like that.
You have another program called Can We Talk?
Yes. This is Chris Cetullo, you might remember, was the news director at WHYY and was at the Inquirer. And his colleague, Dr. Harris Sokolov, who's a professor at Penn in the Graduate School of Education, used their research to create a program to teach the skills of productive dialogue, something that we've certainly noticed, right? It's easier to be in your own bubbles and not engage with the other side. That is basically also admitting that you want things to stay exactly the same. No one side is going to have enough support to completely dominate the other side, right? So in lieu of that, we have to figure out how to work together and talk. And it's a skill. It's not, it doesn't come naturally. I don't know about you, but when I'm in very contentious policy discussions or things like that, sometimes you just think, I'm going to keep my head down. I'm not going to say anything. I'm
agree.
You know, I'm going to make all these value judgments about the other person and keep my mouth shut. But this really does go back and teaches all the different skills, how to approach the conversation, what active listening looks like, engaging in dialogue, not with the intention of necessarily convincing the other person to change their opinion.
Love it.
But just finding where are those areas of common ground and how do we move forward, right? We're not going to agree on every single thing, but let's find that shared value, that shared strategy that can bring us together and march us forward so we're not stuck in these terrible patterns we're in right now.
Yes. And where do you find your audience to participate in the program?
As with a lot of things, we start with mandatory fun. So we go to schools that require their students to participate.
So it's a student program.
It's both now. Okay. So we've expanded, actually. It started as a college program that the University of Pennsylvania ran. And they worked with other universities like Eastern or Gannon University out in Erie, places where the students might not have exactly the same perspective as the students at Penn. And it was fascinating to watch. Mm-hmm. There's recordings of it. It's really interesting what those results were. And then we thought, you know, this isn't just for college students, right? Obviously, adults need this. And Chris Atullo and Harris Sokolov have used this model working with parents in a school district, you know, trying to identify their next superintendent. What do they need? What do they think that let's all come together? Mm-hmm. And how do we share our values and our thoughts together? So there's all kinds of examples of it happening with adults. And then we were just really fortunate to receive a grant to allow us to expand it to high schools.
Oh, that's great.
And especially, I think, with the conflict in the Middle East, a lot of students who previously thought their friends all thought the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. It was us and there was a them, mm-hmm. and they didn't really have to interact with it. We're now really confronted with people they deeply cared about holding maybe shockingly different views mm-hmm. than they held, and having absolutely no skills to dive into that. And they were like, oh, does this mean I have to cut this person off now? Right. And there's already a mental health crisis in high school. So we think that these skills, that practicing this program will really help alleviate a lot of that and give, if not a safe space, a brave space mm-hmm. to have those conversations.
Oh, that's great work, Lauren. I mean, you think about trying to promote respectful, civil dialogue. Without this polarization that is constantly happening, constantly hear about, starting with young people on that topic.
Yeah, and it's not just a matter of being polite, right? It's saying, if you don't like the status quo, we need to find a way to talk to each other.
Yes.
Right? There needs to be a productive dialogue.
Yes.
This isn't, you know, a free pass to minimize people's humanity or to be disrespectful, but really just the tools to move forward.
So do you have any advice for voters on how we can stay informed and actively participate in the democratic process?
Yes, I've got lots of thoughts on this. But I think the first thing is to acknowledge the desire to tune it all out. Like, I get it. I get it. It's overwhelming. It's a roller coaster. There's always something either infuriating or in the news. I get it. And I think what I have found and what has proven true multiple times over my life is when that desire to just be like, wash your hands of it. I'm going to put my head in the sand until after this election, stop texting me, mm-hmm. is to say, like, what's the one thing I can do right now? Mm-hmm. I can't control all of that. I can't control the ages of the candidates on the ballot. Yeah. I can't control all of these things that might be infuriating. I can control the next thing I can do, right? So whether that's signing up to be a poll worker, mm-hmm. talking to three friends and asking them if they've checked their voter registration or if they have a plan to vote, right? We know that even asking if you have a plan to vote ups the odds of voting by like 8 or 10%, which in a close election is everything, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. There's always something more we can do. And in that action, we can take a little bit of control in an arena that feels like it's completely out of our control, right? Mm-hmm. So definitely encouraging people to think about where they are on their civic ladder of engagement mm-hmm. and what's that next thing they can do. As for being informed, I do not watch 1 second of cable television mm-hmm. news. And mm-hmm. I'd like to think I'm a pretty informed person. So you find those ways. And also a diversity of perspectives, right? Like I go out of my way to burst my media bubble, right? Mm-hmm. You want to have a balanced media diet. And I think mm-hmm. looking at your own habits and where you're getting your news, and is it just reading the headline and as you scroll on Instagram or Facebook mm-hmm. or somebody sends you an article, do you really read it? Is it, you know, mm-hmm. you just share the outrage about it? Mm-hmm. So really taking a close look at our own media diets is so important, and making sure that we're getting a variety of information. I also love organizations like factcheck.org and NewsGuard, right? NewsGuard has a red, yellow, green kind of system for flagging content, and based on objective measures, like, is it edited? Do they have an editor? Mm-hmm. Right? Somebody holds
simple
them.
As that.
Yeah. It's the little things right now that go a long way, but we know fact checking people doesn't always convince them, mm-hmm. but at least when we're talking about ourselves and our own media diet, things like that help.
Great advice. So what are some of the common misconceptions about elections that you would like to address?
Oh my goodness. this, that it has to be overwhelming or or crazy contentious, all of these things. I think now that we've kind of mapped our political identities onto every part of ourselves, right? Where we live, what we read, who we associate with, right? Yeah. It's become so pervasive. That's really dangerous, right? So I think one of the misconceptions I have too is our nonpartisan status, right? We're kind of above the fray where we want people to examine their own values and to really look at the candidates and see if they're matching, right? If their plans match, you know, what your values are, then great, go vote for whoever you want to vote for. I truly believe that. And I do think with a free press, right, where people have access to good information, let people compete, let that happen. So yes, so I would say the difference between nonpartisan and bipartisan, right, where bipartisan is just making sure both sides get heard. Nonpartisan is kind of staying above that, above that fray. That's one big one, I would say.
Anything about Committee of 70, your programs, your mission, philosophy that we haven't covered yet that you'd like to talk about?
I think historically, Committee of 70 has been seen as like an elite, center city, white man organization. I'd like to think that my leadership signals a change in that. We've certainly hit 50-50 men and women on the board.
Nice.
More than doubled our people of color, still working to get parity on that side. Added women and people of color to the staff so that our work can be more reflective of the communities we're trying to serve.
Love it.
And it's exciting. It's like such an exciting time to be doing this work with the people that we've been lucky enough to bring into the fold. And I just think we have such a strong message. It's just a matter of getting it out there. I think people have really it's resonated with a lot of people. So the more people we can reach and the opportunities like this to reach new audiences are so important. So thank you for that.
Oh, you're so welcome. This is called Mission Business. And we talked about the mission part. Let's talk a little bit about the business part.
Sure.
Tell me about your fundraising at Committee of 70. Where does the money come from to support all your programs?
So when I started 6 years ago, we were overwhelmingly reliant on board support. So that was about 55 board members who would receive, you know, between 10 and 15, maybe more $1,000 from their organizations to be represented on the board. We've grown the size of the board, but we've also grown our outside funding. So the support we receive from the board makes up about 40 to 45% in any given year. We have about 70 board members now. So on brand. So it works.
It's a big board. Of 70.
Yes, it is a big board. That is not where the name comes from, but it's a big board. So then we are so fortunate to have these strong programs that we've shared, right? The Ballot PA Project, Draw the Lines, We Vote, our poll worker program, the Youth Civics, that receive grant funding. So both here in Philadelphia, I am thrilled, this is my first time publicly sharing this, that we received an $800,000 20-month grant from the William Penn Foundation.
Oh, congrats.
Thank you. We receive support from the AGWA Fund, different national organizations that support our work. And then also the foundations in Pittsburgh have really responded to the civic education work and our work to engage voters across the state. So the Heinz Foundation, Hillman Foundations have been really generously supporting us. And that's a great model for us, right? The programming can continue and expand with that kind of support. So when I started, I think we were at a $1.5, $1.6 million budget. We're at $2.2 right now.
Oh, wow. That's great, Lauren. So your part-time controller has worked with Committee of 70. I don't even know how many years.
Predates me.
It's a very long time, a very long time. And you use our model for your finance department. How's it working out? I mean, I guess I'm taking a risk just asking you.
No, it's fantastic. That was one of the things that I loved. And I think our CFO was surprised, but I wanted to be in the finances and see how the reporting was going and what the balance sheet looked like. And they make it so easy. Our mm-hmm. people from your part-time controller yeah. are members of our team. I remember Alan Stack when I had a house fire and he had kind of recently gone through it himself. He was a resource beyond the regular financial advice. So they really do become members of our team. Mm-hmm. And we're so grateful for the support. I don't know. Dan certainly couldn't do it all by himself. And it's also just an extra control. You know, it helps to know that we have another mm-hmm. pair of eyes in our books.
Mm-hmm. So how's your finance department set up with us as part of it? Or are we doing everything for you?
No, they reconcile the books at the end of the month and create our balance sheet and all of that good stuff in close work with our CFO. Mm-hmm. And then at audit time, it's all hands on deck. So yes. everyone digging yes. into the books.
So it's an interesting model where you have a full-time CFO mm-hmm. on staff and we're there supplementing as the part-time controller.
Exactly right.
Exactly fitting our name in that. So love that.
Yeah, it works really well for us.
Yeah, some people, you know, don't realize that your part-time controller works with different models of how organizations have their finance department set up. Sometimes there isn't a CFO and we do everything from soup to nuts. And then sometimes there's a whole staff and we're working as part of the finance team, whole finance team staff, and work as just a small part of that. Lauren, it was a pleasure talking to you today. And thank you for joining Mission Business Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. This is great.
That was my conversation with Lauren Cristella, President and CEO of Committee of 70. Thanks to Lauren for joining me. You can find out more information about the Committee of 70 and the work that they do at 70.org. I want to thank the team at PWP Video for their guidance and assistance in the development and production of this podcast. They are a great partner for Media with a Mission, and you can find them at pwpvideo.com. Additional information about this episode can be found at missionbusinesspod.com. And follow us on social media at Mission Business Pod on Instagram and Facebook, and at Mission Biz Pod on X, formerly known as Twitter. This podcast was produced by Erica Blair and Geraldine Dressler of Your Part-Time Controller, LLC. Dave Winston and Michael Schweizheimer are our producers from PWP Video, and the show was directed and edited by Pat Ganley. Again, I'm Jennifer Oliva, and we'll see you here next time on Mission Business, presented by Your Part-Time Controller, LLC.